The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jackie Marino for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Nutrition News. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Nutrition Action Health Letter. Five Ideas to Doubt, Believe It or Not, by Bonnie Liebman. When it comes to food and supplements, confusion abounds. One reason? Some ideas catch on and linger, despite iffy evidence or, worse yet, studies that prove them flat out wrong. Here's a handful of beliefs to doubt. 1. Low-carb diets can starve cancer. Sugar feeds cancer. Videos had roughly 5.5 million views on TikTok as of mid-June, says David Robert Grimes, an adjunct assistant professor at the Trinity College Dublin School of Medicine. And keto diet cancer videos had 2.7 billion views. The best myths have a kernel of truth in them, notes Grimes, but it gets misunderstood. Here, that kernel is the Warburg effect, named after Otto Warburg, a German scientist who first wrote about the cancer cells in the 1920s. It's the observation that tumors consume more glucose than you would expect, explains Grimes. So people say, tumors really like sugar, so if I don't eat sugar, I won't feed this cancer. But it's a huge leap to assume that a low-carb or keto diet slows or stops cancer. Tumor cells need more glucose in part because they use an inefficient pathway to generate energy. Normal cells use oxygen to produce energy because it's efficient, says Grimes. But we do have a backup system used by bacteria that doesn't need oxygen. Most tumors use this pathway even when ample oxygen is available. That switch in pathways might trigger cancer, suggested Warburg. We've since discovered that the Warburg effect is a consequence of cancer, not a cause of it, says Grimes. The mutations that allow cancer to evolve in the first place often switch back to those earlier evolutionary pathways. Do low-carb diets help people with cancer live longer? According to the U.S. Registry of Studies on People, clinicaltrials.gov, 23 trials of a keto diet and cancer are getting started or in progress. 14 have been terminated or withdrawn or have unknown status. Of the 14 completed trials, results are either unpublished or inconclusive. When you look at the data, it's underwhelming or far too preliminary, says Grimes. Most published studies are poorly done, have high risk of bias, and offer little or no data on survival. There is insufficient evidence to recommend for or against any diet for patients with cancer, says the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And a low-carb diet may cause harm. The risk is that patients may end up with rapid weight loss, says Grimes. Cancer patients often battle to keep from losing weight. You don't want to exacerbate that. Belief in a low-carb diet can also lead to shaming, he adds. Patients are already suffering enough. I've seen people telling them, you wouldn't have cancer if you'd eaten less sugar. Carbs may also help patients cope with chemotherapy. When my friend was going through cancer, her one comfort food was a candy we call jelly tots. If something helps people get through chemo, don't deny it to them, says Grimes. It's such an unhelpful thing to burden them with on top of everything else. Simple narratives are appealing, but they tend to be wrong and sometimes dangerous. 2. It's easy to keep weight off. The good news is, with a little planning and focused effort, you can maintain your weight loss without dieting, says VeryWellFit.com. The website's simple strategies, being mindful, exercise, being prepared for setbacks, strength training, and an 80-20 approach, 80% of your meals are nutritious and 20% aren't. Dieters typically regain more than 75% of their lost weight after 5 years. The good news? Researchers are hunting for clues to figure out what drives people to gain or regain weight. People still think obesity is mainly caused by a lack of willpower, says Muriel Serley, a professor of internal medicine at the Yale University School of Medicine. But few scientists pin the blame on missing willpower. Serley's team wanted to know if food in the stomach leads to a different response in the brains of people with obesity than in the brains of those with normal weight. Is the brain sensing that there's food in the gastrointestinal tract differently in people with obesity, she suggests. To rule out the influence of the taste, smell, or sight of food or food preferences, the researchers fed people either sugar or fat using a nasal tube. In people with healthy weight, we found a decrease in brain activity in about 30 different regions of the brain, including areas that are involved in rewarding aspects of food, explained Surley. That makes sense because if there's food in the gastrointestinal tract, there is no need to search for more food, so brain activity in those areas was shut down. But brain activity didn't drop after her team delivered sugar or fat into the stomachs of people with obesity, nor did brain activity fall when Surley retested those people after they had cut enough calories to lose 10% of their initial weight. On average, they dropped from roughly 222 pounds to 200 pounds. If the brain is not perceiving that there are 500 calories in the gastrointestinal tract, then I need to look for food and eat signals are still ongoing, says Surley. That is exactly what I hear from patients with obesity. They say, I just finished my dinner, I know I ate enough calories, but it doesn't feel like it. We think that is due to a miscommunication between the GI tract and the brain. What leads to that miscommunication isn't clear. The environment we live in, where unhealthy food is available all the time, contributes to overeating, says Surley. At some point, that might disrupt how the brain regulates what we eat. More evidence that biology matters? Few people who lose a substantial amount of weight can keep it off without surgery or drugs like semaglutide, Wegovy, or tirzepatide, Zepbound. It's hard to lose weight and keep it off if the brain keeps telling you, eat, says Surley. It's hard to fight that. 3. Antioxidants can prevent cancer. Antioxidant, an essential nutrient, says the Nature Made Vitamin E label. Antioxidant that neutralizes free radicals in the body, says its website. That sure sounds good. After all, free radicals may trigger cancer by damaging DNA. But vitamin E didn't prevent cancer in the recent CELNIB trial. In fact, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer was more likely to recur in people who were randomly assigned to take a high daily dose of vitamin E, 200 IU, than in those who got a placebo for roughly 1.5 years. Antioxidant vitamins have not been shown to reduce the risk of any cancer, and concerns have been raised about increased risks with several of them, says Joanne Manson, chief of preventative medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. For example, high-dose beta-carotene was linked to an increased risk of lung cancer among Finnish smokers in the ATBC trial, and then high-dose vitamin E was linked to an increased risk of prostate cancer in the SELECT trial. And now a signal for an increased risk of recurrent bladder cancer with vitamin E has emerged in this new trial. And the trials have been huge. We studied antioxidant vitamins in some of the largest trials ever done, ranging from between 8,000 and 39,000 participants, says Manson. The Physicians Health Study 1 and 2, the Women's Health Study, and the Women's Antioxidant Cardiovascular Study tested vitamin E, vitamin C, and or beta-carotene. None saw benefits for cancer or heart disease, notes Manson. And high doses of vitamin E have been linked to bleeding risks, she adds. Hemorrhagic stroke was increased in the Physicians Health Study trial, too. These high doses cannot be assumed to be safe. How might high dose cause harm? Some antioxidants may actually become prooxidants, creating more free radicals, says Manson. And very high doses of beta-carotene might interfere with the absorption or bioavailability of other carotenoids. Why are antioxidants still appealing? There's a perception that antioxidants are healthy and beneficial, says Manson. I think it's because of marketing. Fruits and vegetables are described as antioxidant-rich, so people think, oh, it's good to look for antioxidants. Her advice? Avoid taking high doses of any vitamins, minerals, or dietary supplements unless they're recommended by a clinician. 4. Low glycemic foods are better for you? The glycemic index is a measure used to determine how much a food can affect your blood sugar levels, says Healthline. Using the index can also enhance weight loss, decrease your blood sugar levels, and reduce your cholesterol. But the evidence that the glycemic index, or GI, affects anything is skimpy. Some research shows that following a low GI diet may increase short-term weight loss, says Healthline. Yet the website's trusted sources report that people randomly assigned to eat a low GI diet lost no more weight than people on a high GI diet. In theory, high GI foods like potatoes, bread, and sugary drinks cause blood sugar spikes that eventually make your body resistant to insulin, which boosts the risk of type 2 diabetes. When you're insulin resistant, your insulin has trouble moving blood sugar into cells. So the OmniCarb trial tested four healthy diets, either high or low glycemic index and either high or low carb, for 5 weeks each in people with excess weight and high blood pressure. The results? The glycemic index had no favorable effect on insulin resistance, blood sugar pressure, or LDL cholesterol, says Frank Sachs, professor emeritus of cardiovascular disease prevention and medicine at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In fact, when people ate the higher carb diet, low glycemic carbs made insulin sensitivity worse. And the glycemic index is complicated and difficult to use, says Sachs. For example, if you chew the food a lot, the glycemic index goes up because it breaks down the carbs. Other surprises, bread typically has a higher GI than pasta, whole grain or not. And baked potatoes have a higher GI than French fries because the fries' fat makes them be absorbed more slowly. And some brown rices have a high glycemic index while others are lower, says Sachs. It's impossible to deal with pragmatically. What's more, the American Diabetes Association doesn't mention a low GI diet as one of several, like DASH, Mediterranean, or low carb, that may help prevent type 2 diabetes. The good news? Some studies now divide carbs into high quality, whole grain, fruit, and non-starchy vegetables, versus low quality, starches and added sugar. That makes sense, says Sachs. There may be differences in insulin response among carbohydrate-containing foods, but the glycemic index is not a good measure of that. 5. Immune supplements ward off colds and flu? It all started in 1970 when Nobel Prize winner Linus Pauling recommended megadoses of vitamin C, at least 1,000 milligrams a day, to ward off or shorten colds. 50 years later, Emergen-C, Ester-C, Airborne, and similar supplements are still cashing in on that recommendation. Most also toss in other ingredients. The latest fad, elderberry gummies. Nature's Way combined elderberries with vitamin C, D, and zinc for powerful immune support, says the ad for Nature's Way Sambucus Immune Gummy Elderberry. How's the evidence? Weak. Vitamin C. In 7 trials, taking roughly 3,000 milligrams a day at the first sneeze didn't make colds milder or shorter. And in 24 trials, those who took 200 to 2,000 milligrams a day for an average of 3 months were no less likely to catch a cold. Among adults who did get sick, vitamin C cut just half a day off the average week-long cold. Exception? In people doing intense exercise, we're talking ultra-marathons, taking 250 to 1,000 milligrams a day cut the risk of catching a cold in half. Elderberry. In the best study so far, researchers randomly assigned 87 patients with the flu to take a tablespoon of elderberry syrup, Sambucol, or a placebo 4 times a day. Symptoms lasted 5 days in both groups. Vitamin D. In 43 trials on nearly 50,000 people, acute respiratory infections occurred in 61% of vitamin D takers versus 62% of placebo takers. While the difference was statistically significant, it's trivial. And in 2 trials, 400 to 3,200 IU a day didn't help prevent COVID. Zinc. Sucking on a zinc lozenge shortened colds in some earlier trials, but not in others. Few recent trials have tested zinc tablets or gummies that are sold for immune support. And now a recipe from the healthy cook, Kate Sherwood. Go fish. Start with the freshest fish you can find. It should smell pleasantly briny, like the sea, not fishy. Ask the person behind the fish counter which one they choose today. When in doubt, hit the freezer case. White fish with avocado lime sauce. Be sure not to zest the lime's pith, the white bitter part of the rind. For the most vibrant colored avocado lime sauce, use yellow tomatoes instead of red ones. Ingredients: 1 mini cucumber, 1 cup mixed cherry tomatoes, 1 lime, 1/2 avocado, 1/4 teaspoon plus 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 4 6.5 boneless skinless whitefish fillets, 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 1 raw cob corn kernels cut off. Chop the cucumber and tomatoes. Lightly zest, then juice the lime. It should yield about 2 tablespoons juice. Make the avocado lime sauce. In a blender, puree the cucumber, lime zest, and juice, avocado, 1/4 teaspoon salt, and 1/2 the tomatoes until very smooth. Blot the fish dry with a paper towel. Season with the remaining 1/4 cup salt, or 1/4 teaspoon salt, rather. In a large nonstick pan over medium heat, heat the oil until shimmering. Sauté the fish until browned, 2 to 3 minutes. Gently turn over the fish and reduce the heat to medium-low. Sauté until the fish easily flakes, 30 seconds to 5 minutes, depending on the thickness of the fillets. Remove to a platter. Top with the avocado lime sauce, corn, and remaining tomatoes. Note: use a sustainable variety of cod, haddock, tilapia, or other white fish. Look for the MSC Blue Certification logo or go to seafoodwatch.org. Next on the table, nutty spring asparagus. This simple dish is delicious served chilled or at room temperature. Not a mayo fan? Substitute 1 tablespoon plain yogurt plus 1 tablespoon extra virgin olive oil. Bonus, the topping is also great on green beans or broccoli slaw. Ingredients: 1 pound asparagus trimmed, 1/4 cup roasted salted pistachios, 2 tablespoons mayonnaise, 1 teaspoon lemon zest, 1 tablespoon fresh lemon juice, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt. Lightly steam the asparagus until just tender crisp, 2 to 3 minutes, then immediately run under cold water to avoid overcooking. Pat dry with a paper towel and transfer to a serving dish. Roughly chop the pistachios, then set aside 3 tablespoons and mince the rest. Make the sauce. In a bowl, whisk together the mayonnaise, lemon zest, and juice, salt, and minced pistachios. Spoon the sauce over the asparagus and top with the chopped pistachios. Feeling the Heat: How Heat Can Kill, by Bonnie Liebman. Heat waves are getting hotter, longer, more frequent, and you're getting less relief at night, said Ken Graham, director of the National Weather Service, last April. As the Earth keeps blowing past earlier heat records, here's how to know and how to protect yourself. 1. How heat kills. Heat is a silent killer, says Christy Ebby, professor of global health at the University of Washington. People typically have a low awareness that heat can be deadly, so they can't take actions to protect themselves. Heat stroke, the most dangerous heat-related illness, is a medical emergency. More than 1/2 of older heat stroke victims die. To understand how heat kills, it helps to know how the body cools itself off. Sweating. When sweat from the body's 2 to 4 million sweat glands evaporates, it cools the skin, but may hasten dehydration. Moving blood to the skin. You want to get that hot blood from the body's core to the skin, says Robert Mead, research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Why? When tiny blood vessels in the skin dilate, that is, expand, they release heat like a radiator. But if enough blood gets shifted to the skin, too little is left for the internal organs, including the GI tract. The intestines start to become more permeable, explains Mead, so toxins from the heat gut start to flood into the bloodstream. And that can set off another crisis. The toxins can trigger a systematic inflammatory response, says Mead. In many ways, heat stroke is similar to sepsis. That's an extreme body-wide immune reaction to an infection. The systemic inflammatory response changes how the blood clots, so it can cause disseminated intravascular coagulation, blood clots in the blood vessels, Mead explains. And when the brain gets hot enough, we start to see neurological effects, so people become very confused. The end result? Cells die and critical organs fail. The heat just wreaks havoc on the entire body, says Mead. Heat strains the heart. Though heat stroke can be deadly, cardiovascular disease takes the most lives in a heat wave. Heart disease puts you at a greater risk because your heart is less able to tolerate the higher heat, says Abby. And many people who have underlying heart disease don't know it. How does heat strain the heart? When the blood vessels in the skin open up, you have the same amount of fluid in a large container, so blood pressure drops, explains Mead. Sweating makes it worse. When we sweat, we're losing fluid, so we can become dehydrated, he adds. Like a hose with less water, that also lowers blood pressure. To maintain sufficient blood pressure to feed vital organs, the heart needs to work harder and beat faster. The heart isn't working as hard as it does when you're exercising, but during a heat wave, we're talking about constant stress over a day or multiple days. In a person who has underlying cardiovascular issues, that cumulative strain could be dangerous. What else heightens your heart your heat risk? It's not just heart problems. There's a long list of vulnerabilities that put people at higher risk from heat, says Abby. Among them, diabetes. Our lab has shown that type 2 diabetes reduces the body's capacity to thermoregulate, that is, to boost sweating and blood flow to the skin, notes Mead, referring to research done by his former colleagues at the University of Ottawa. And diabetes often comes with a host of cardiovascular and kidney complications that also raise risk. Kidney disease. As we get older, our kidney's ability to filter is already reduced, says Mead. So heat is another stress on top of that. And if someone already has weak kidneys, heat can precipitate kidney failure. How? If heat stress is extreme, it can reduce blood flow to the kidney and reduce how much fluid the kidney is processing, explains Mead. That can cause acute kidney injury. Lung disease. Heat stress can worsen respiratory conditions like asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, though spikes in air pollution triggered by heat waves are also partly to blame. Age. In one University of Ottawa study, after 2 hours in 98-degree Fahrenheit heat, 12 people mostly aged 60 to 70 gained more body heat than 12 people mostly aged 18 to 24. Why do older people gain more heat? They may sweat less, their blood vessels dilate less, and their hearts are less able to pump harder and faster. But there's a huge amount of variation in how people respond to heat stress, notes Mead. Staying fit may boost your resilience. His team compared 38 physically fit adults aged 18 to 66 to 35 less fit similar adults during 30-minute bouts of cycling in 104-degree heat. Those who had high levels of physical fitness had less age-related decline in thermal regulation, says Mead. Being physically fit may help during heat stress because some responses, like an increased heart rate, are similar to our response to exercise. That said, more studies testing fit and less fit older people are needed. One caution, for the same degree of dehydration, older people are not as thirsty, notes Mead. So you have to drink even if you're not thirsty. Staying hydrated is very important, he adds, but don't overdo it if you're only drinking water. That can severely dilute sodium levels in the blood. A good rule of thumb, your urine should be the color of lemonade. If it's darker, you may be dehydrated. If it's colorless, you may be overhydrated. Most packaged foods can help restore sodium. That includes yogurt, milk, bread, and other foods that may not taste salty. Heat may also reduce appetite, so remember to eat, Mead advises. Medications can worsen heat stress. Dozens of drugs may impair the body's ability to handle excess heat. Some may be surprising. Antihistamines like Benadryl have anticholinergic properties, says Mead. They block the receptor that activates sweat glands, so you may have a reduced sweating response. Antihistamines may also constrict small blood vessels in the skin, making it harder to release body heat. Diuretics are easier to wrap your head around because they reduce the amount of fluid in your body, says Mead. Other drugs that lower blood pressure may also boost heat risk. Beta blockers reduce heart rate, notes Mead, and calcium channel blockers curb the heart's contractions. Many drugs that promote mental health, like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, tricyclic antidepressants, and lithium, may also alter the body's response to heat. Check with your doctor or pharmacist if you're taking any prescription meds. Check your heat risk. Last year, heat-related illness caused over 120,000 emergency department visits, said Mandy Cohen, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at a press conference last April. To be prepared this summer, CDC has developed a new dashboard that includes the National Weather Service's heat risk map and EPA's AirNow Air Quality Index. The heat risk results depend not just on temperature, but also on humidity. When the humidity is high, sweat may drip off your body, but you get no cooler if the sweat doesn't evaporate, explains Mead. And keep in mind that a heat wave is riskier if it hits early in the summer because we're not yet acclimated. The more we're exposed to heat, the better the body is at dealing with it, says Mead. The CDC's heat risk website also links to local cooling centers for people who have no air conditioning. If you feel poorly, reach out to someone. Don't wait, says Mead. And expect more records to fall. Insane heat has been scorching Miami, ran the New York Times headline in May. It's not even June. Miami's heat index, which takes humidity into account, reached 112 degrees on May 18th and 19th, breaking the previous daily record by an astonishing 11 degrees, noted the Times. Yet in April, the paper added, Florida enacted a law banning local governments from requiring heat and water breaks for outdoor workers. High temperatures can be deadly, but almost all of those deaths are preventable, says the University of Washington's Christy Ebby. No one has to die in a heat wave. You can see a 7-day heat risk forecast for most U.S. area codes using a new website from the CDC, cdc.gov/heatrisk. We've run out of time for today's episode of Nutrition News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jackie Marino, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Nutrition News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.